You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works 75 by Rudolf Steiner, a set of lectures given from June 17, 1920, and May 11, 1922, five public lectures, and a disputation evening held in various cities in Switzerland and Germany. Translated by Sabine Seiler, readers aside, I hope that I am saying her name correctly, and readers aside. The book is entitled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, Foundations and Methods. Part 1, Lecture 1, entitled Spiritual Science, Natural Science, and Technology, given in Stuttgart on June 17, 1920. Ladies and gentlemen, dear students, today I will present a few findings to you from what I have for a number of years called anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. And I am doing so in the awareness that on this evening, in this first lecture, I will not be able to do more than give you a few introductory ideas. I do not have any illusions that such a presentation can bring about instant conviction. But it may be possible that in the discussion following the general characterization I will present to you, special wishes can be satisfied and specific questions addressed. In order to not take up too much time, I want to start right away by talking about what is essential first, and that is to characterize what anthroposophically oriented spiritual science really wants to be. It differs from what is generally called science in the methods of its research. Indeed, anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is convinced that any serious and sincere striving in the modern sciences, if pursued consistently, will necessarily ultimately lead to its method. I want to speak to you in a scientific sense, because after all, I myself did not start from some view of theology, from some questions about world views, or from philosophy in the sense in which people usually understand those things. Rather, I started with technical studies. And these technical studies led me to the realization that this spiritual science is a necessity at this time in our historical development. That is why I feel especially glad to be able to speak this evening particularly to you. When we are working in the natural sciences, as is commonly understood in contemporary thinking, we are, first of all, dealing with something that is spread all around us, namely the world of sensory facts. And we then apply our thinking, specifically our methodically trained thinking, to discover laws by appropriately examining these sensory facts. We look for what we have become used to calling natural laws, laws of history, and so on. Now, this way of relating to the world is not something spiritual science rejects. Rather, it wants to base itself on the solid ground of this scientific research. But standing on this solid ground, it pursues its studies starting from the point of view of human life itself. Precisely because spiritual science is serious about the natural sciences, it simply comes to those limits of scientific understanding that are even admitted by level-headed natural scientists. And in regard to what the natural sciences can be, spiritual science is completely in agreement with those who say, by summarizing external facts, we can advance with scientific methods up to a certain level. But we cannot get beyond a certain limit as long as we ourselves remain within the paradigm of this natural scientific research. Only when we have reached what we are striving for in ordinary life and what the natural sciences are aiming for, do we come to the beginning of what is sought for by the spiritual science described here. By understanding the facts around us with our thinking, we arrive at certain boundary concepts, I will only mention a few boundary concepts here, regardless of whether they are understood as mere functions or as realities. I mean boundary concepts such as atom, matter, and so on. In any case, we operate with these boundary concepts, even if we do not look for demonic beings standing behind them. We encounter such boundary concepts especially when we are active in the branches of the sciences that are fundamental for technology. There, in a sense, those boundary concepts stand like pillars. And as long as we wish to remain within the confines of ordinary science, we come to a standstill at these boundary pillars. For those active in the spiritual science meant here, the actual work only starts at those boundary posts. This means that those spiritual scientists enter into a certain kind of inner struggle in what I call meditation. Please don't take exception to that term. It's simply a technical term like many others. This inner struggle involves those concepts, more or less all those boundary concepts of natural science. And this inner struggle turns out to be a fruitful one for those engaged in it. This reminds me of a man who taught here in this city, at this university, in the second half of the 19th century, and who again and again emphasized this struggle in which people are engaged when they run into the limits of ordinary science. The man I am referring to was Friedrich Theodor Fischer. He knew a thing or two about what people can experience when they encounter concepts such as atom, matter, natural law, force, and so on. What I mean here is not some sort of brooding, but rather it is a summoning of everything within our soul that has led us to these concepts, so that we can then try to live with those concepts meditatively. What exactly does that mean? It means establishing within ourselves inner discipline, so that we can look inside ourselves at what we have in our soul when we arrive at such a boundary concept, and to look in the same way we usually look at external objects. Of course, I mentioned only a few boundary concepts. There are more, and I could name others. But what matters is that when we try to focus our whole soul only on such concepts, abstracting ourselves from all other experiences, then we make an inner discovery. An inner discovery that is unsettling, harrowing. It shows us that seen from a certain point of life, of our inner life, our concepts become things that grow on their own in our soul, and that behave quite differently after such meditative work than when we take them only as a result of observation of the external world. Just as we can observe that as children grow up, certain organs that are at first undifferentiated become increasingly differentiated, that as we observe that organs are growing, likewise, we feel in such a meditative dedication to the results of scientific experience that inner growth happens in our soul. And then comes the unsettling insight when we realize that it is not through speculation or speculative philosophy that we can advance beyond what we call the limits of our knowledge of nature. We can advance beyond that limit only through direct, unmediated experience. Only when we transform what we have gained with thinking into an inner experience of contemplation or beholding. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the first step we take. In other words, we can clearly sense that the method becomes quite different than the ordinary scientific method, which I, more than anyone, can objectively accept, and that, therefore, something new is entering upon the scene. Namely, that mere thinking, mere comprehending, turns into inner experiencing. And that is when consistent, patient, and sustained experiencing in this direction, will lead to what we ultimately cannot call anything other than an experience of spiritual existence. From the point of view of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, we cannot speak about this experiencing of the spiritual world in any other way. For this experience of the spiritual world is not a given for human beings. Rather, this is something we must fight to achieve. When we advance to a certain level of this experience, then we notice that the thinking we usually engage in and use as our tool for understanding the world around us, this thinking now stands in a quite different relationship to our entire bodily being than we would have assumed, based merely on our knowledge of nature. Even solely on the basis of a knowledge of nature, we are aware that with the bodily changes and transformations that happen over time, from youth to old age and so on, our soul also undergoes changing conditions. One can advance physiologically using natural scientific thinking. For example, it is possible to show that in fact in the nervous system, in the brain, there is an expression of the structure, the configuration of our thinking. And there, when we follow up the matter consistently from a particular point of view, we indeed find that thinking, our life in thoughts, emerges from something we can at best hypothesize about today. People who have experienced inwardly what I have characterized as experienceable will say something else. They will say that when we walk on a muddy road, for example, or drive on a muddy road, we leave ruts or imprints of our footsteps. It would obviously be totally wrong if out of ignorance we then were to come up with a theory that an extraterrestrial being had made those ruts and footprints, or if we were to come up with the hypothesis that there are forces under the Earth's surface that work in such a way as to cause these ruts and footprints. Thus, people say, and I emphasize that to a certain extent it is right to say this, that based on insights from the natural sciences, the physiological structure of the brain is what ultimately comes to expression in the function of thinking. But those who have experienced what I have described will not agree. They will say that just as those ruts and footprints have not been caused from the interior of the earth through some internal force, but rather by something that drove or walked over the ground there, so the physical brain has been shaped into its furrows by body-free thinking. And what can still to a certain extent change these furrows after we have entered physical life at birth is what, descending from the spiritual worlds, does the work of shaping these furrows to begin with. This is how we arrive at the insight that the soul is indeed the active element. It is the soul that shapes and designs the bodily form. Ladies and gentlemen, I know that from the intellectual and theoretical standpoint, of course, hundreds of objections can be raised against what I am saying here. But spiritual science must point to experience. It must point out that until we have the experience I just described, we feel justified in believing that our thoughts emerge out of the physical brain as a function of it, whereas when we ourselves experience this thought life, then we know how active it is in itself, that it has its own intrinsic being and is in constant movement. That is, we know that this thought life is actually what is active compared to the passive corporeality. This is, in a way, the first experience that presents itself to us as something we do not attain by means of a straight, linear continuation of the methods of ordinary science. Rather, we attain this only through a metamorphosis, through a transformation of the ordinary scientific method into a method that is solely experiential, a method that is made up not of speculation, but of inner experiencing. That is one side of the issue. The other side of this inner experiencing concerns the inner development of our will. When you look at your life, you can see the transformations you have undergone in the course of your life. You can call to mind what your inner psychological and outer physical condition was like 1 year ago, 5 years ago, or even 10 years ago. You have to admit that you have undergone changes, transformations. These changes or metamorphoses, how do you go through them? In a certain sense, we surrender ourselves passively to the external world. After all, just ask yourself, and be honest now, to what extent you are active in what you have become through the external world. The external world, inheritance, upbringing, and so on. All of these shape every one of us. And what shapes us there continues to work on us and have an effect. In general, we are passive in this process. When we now turn this passivity into activity and turn it into what we could call, in the most eminent sense, a self-discipline of the will, and when we do this in the way I will describe for you in a moment, then the second element will be added to the first one we have described on the path of spiritual research. Of course, keep in mind that we reach that level only through methodical training, the one I have described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, as well as in other books. And then we come through this methodical training to the point where we can focus our deliberate intention on at least a small part of what is developing within us. That is, we can deliberately intend to take on this or that and make it one of our character traits. By vigorously activating our will, we can indeed develop that chosen trait, even though it may take years. And thus we take control of what we usually become only passively. That is, if I may say it somewhat personally, we take our will, and thus our development, into our own hands. Of course, this is possible only to a certain extent. When we have achieved this, then what happens is that what is usually just our memory, just recollection, merges in a certain way into a real region. Then we can, in a sense, survey our life as though we were looking at a series of events. In this way, we come to know our will in its true character. We get to know our thinking as something that increasingly detaches itself from the body the more we enter into life. In contrast, we come to know our will as something that increasingly takes hold of the physical body, permeating us more and more and flowing through us. We realize then that basically death is nothing other than a struggle between the will and the physical functions, so that these functions have reached a certain limit when we go through death, whether earlier or later. And at that point, what can no longer work on our body as before, namely the will, then becomes totally absorbed in what the body is doing. This will then detaches itself, and an element of the soul then actually enters into a real spiritual world when we leave this one at our death. Thus, what we are dealing with here is that spiritual science, in the sense meant here, does not pursue and develop the idea of immortality, as it is usually called, through some sort of speculation. In fact, this spiritual science basically breaks completely with the way the world usually approaches this idea. Instead, what we have here is a spiritual science that understands itself as a continuation of the natural sciences, and by way of the discipline of our thinking and willing, comes to grasp what we carry within us, namely thinking and willing, and to understand the development of the latter in such a way as to still grasp this soul element that lives in thinking and willing when it lives on without a body in a form that is inaccessible to our senses. Yes, it is true that what I have explained to you here briefly is considered fantasy or reverie by much of the public of our time. And really, how could it be any other way? Everything new that enters the world and seemingly contradicts what was already there before is at first considered to be something fantastical, to be mere reverie. But I don't believe that this assessment of spiritual science will stand forever. I don't believe that people will always fail to recognize that what has been described here as the method of spiritual science in at least two of its characteristic elements is really only a continuation, albeit a very lively one, of what the natural sciences achieve before they come with their methods to a certain limit beyond which they cannot go. Today, people no longer resent it when we talk about spirit in general. But in the last third of the 19th century, people still got offended at this. Back then, a worldview had been developed in a materialistic way, based on the knowledge of the natural sciences. That worldview was really only attempting to consistently continue the thinking of the natural sciences to its final consequence. Now, it is already acceptable again to speak of spirit, at least speculatively. But people still resent it when we talk of spirit in the way I have just done here, for that entails a certain consequence. When you have attained, in quotes, seeing consciousness, which I describe in my book titled The Riddle of Man, that is, when you have attained what emerges from such a developed thinking and willing, then you know that you are in a spiritual world through this seeing consciousness, just as you know through your eyes and ears that you are in a world of color and sound. In a sense, you will find that everything around you is filled with spirit. This experience is much like that of a person who was born blind and then, after an operation, from a certain moment on, can see colors and finds the world of color opened up. For that person, the surrounding world is now filled with something different. And it is like that for us when we enter into this seeing consciousness. The world we were used to before, which we saw only as the world of the senses and the intellect, is then filled with spirit. And this spirit becomes something concrete for us. That is, this spirit then becomes something we can observe in its concrete form and design, and we no longer need to speak of spirit only in a general way. After all, speaking of the spirit only in general terms is like walking across a meadow with flowers, and when asked about the name of this or that flower, answering only that they are all plants, plants, plants. Along these lines, it is acceptable today to say that there is a spiritual world behind the world of the senses. But spiritual science cannot stop there, but must examine the spiritual facts in their concrete manifestation, if for no other reason than that the spiritual world, just like the world of color and sound, is all around us, and it must examine those facts just as closely as we usually investigate the world of color and sound with our senses and our deductive intellect. In this process, we acquire, above all, a specific way of relating to the world. After all, it is true that if a person is born blind and then suddenly becomes able to see, that person has to develop a different relationship to the world. Such a person must first get his or her bearings. For example, such a person would not know anything about depth perception and would have to learn it first. Likewise, we have to acquire a certain specific relationship, a certain position vis-à-vis the world, when we move into seeing consciousness. And then much will initially seem peculiar to us. And that is one reason why spiritual researchers are still misunderstood by their contemporaries. You see, spiritual researchers actively involved in spiritual science never say that what has been attained with the strict scientific method of the natural sciences and the conclusions drawn from such scientific findings are in any way logically incorrect or anything like that. Nevertheless, they are compelled to contribute to all of that something out of their spiritual perception. And this is not merely a process of simply adding something to the results of natural science. Rather, the contribution from spiritual science, in many ways, completely changes the results of the natural sciences. Let's take geology as an example, and to illustrate my point, I'll take just one example. For it is better to talk about concrete issues than to talk in general phrases and platitudes. I fully understand and could apply and observe this method myself. In our example, then, we look at the rock formations all around us, at the sediments in rivers and other bodies of water, and so on. And we see the geological layers one above the other. And when we examine these layers closely and try to figure out the age of these rock strata, something we can, of course, not calculate exactly, but only approximately, we arrive at the familiar great numbers. And as you all know, we then can go back all the way to the beginning of the Earth's evolution, when Earth, so the hypothesis goes, took shape out of something, out of a kind of primeval nebula or something like that. I don't want to go into details about this. You already know all this. However, things are different for those active in spiritual research. Because these researchers have experienced what I have described, albeit only as a sketch, just to give you an idea, not to convince you of anything, they see the matter as follows. For them, it is like examining the human organism, for example, the human heart, and how it changes over time, let's say, how it changes in the course of 5 years. That is, one examines the heart or any other organ to see how it has changed after 5 years, after 10 years, and so on. And then, based on those observations, through calculations and consistent deduction, one can figure out what the heart was like 300 years ago. Indeed, we can get a result purely through calculations, telling us what the human heart was like 300 years ago. However, here we have to object that this heart did not yet exist back then. Just as the geological view is correct, so this way of looking at the human heart and drawing conclusions from the small changes we see there to infer what this heart was like 300 years ago should also be correct, except that this heart did not yet exist back then. The conclusions drawn from geological facts about the development of the earth are correct in the same way, for I fully acknowledge that the findings of geology are at least relatively correct. But we then shift the results of our calculations into times in which the earth did not yet exist in its current form. Or, by calculating a final state, or talking about entropy and the like, we shift the conclusions drawn from our observations, which were made over a limited period of time, into an epoch that lies millions of years in the future. For those actively doing spiritual research, that is like having to calculate what the condition of the human heart will be 300 years hence. This is what matters when we transform the usual scientific method into something we can experience. You see, the human being is really like an extract of the entire cosmos. In the human being we find, albeit somehow changed and somehow extracted, counterbalanced, or otherwise changed, the law that is present in the entire cosmos. Now, you may call me a dreamer. You may ask how I can claim that the earth did not yet exist in its current form back then. And you may demand that I show you how one arrives at such a claim. I want to tell you how one comes to make such claims as I've just made, but I can only give you a rough outline and won't be able to go into detail. When you experience your willing and thinking as I have described earlier, you will indeed discover that the human being is, in fact, a sort of microcosm. I'm not just saying this as an empty phrase like some hazy mystics do. Rather, I am saying this with the awareness that this has become as clear to me as any solution to a differential equation, namely with the same completely logical clarity. That is, you will discover that inwardly human beings are a sort of summary, a compendium of the entire world. In your ordinary life, you know what is around you in the moment and what you perceive with your senses. But when you ignore the moment and look at the picture of what you have experienced maybe 10 or 15 years ago, what now appears before your mind is something that no longer exists. Even though what you experienced no longer exists, something of that experience is still within you, something that makes it possible for you to reconstruct what existed back then. The same applies to the expanded consciousness that develops as a result of the transformation of ordinary thinking and willing. You see, human beings were actually connected with everything of the past, but in a different, more comprehensive and more spiritual sense than they are connected to experiences that are 10 or 15 years in the past and can be recalled from within. Likewise, once we have expanded our consciousness, it is possible that we find, as though out of a cosmic memory, those events or times at which we were present, but which do not continue to live for us as far as our ordinary consciousness is concerned. They only live on for the consciousness that has come about through the metamorphosis I have described. In other words, we're dealing here with nothing other than an expansion or enhancement of the faculty that is our memory. Through this enhancement, we can, based on our nature, as essentially a precis of the macrocosm, constructively recall and bring to life before our minds what was actually the case in a particular phase of our Earth's history. We can then look at the Earth when it did not yet have a material existence. Whereas in other cases, we have to construe something about what supposedly happened in the past based on the current experiences of geology, we can now look at a point in time when the Earth did not yet exist as such, but was present only in a much more spiritual form. That is, by constructively recreating what lives within us, we can see what actually lies at the basis of the formation of our Earth. And the same applies to anything constructive that can in some way rise up within us regarding a future condition of the Earth. I know that such sketchy descriptions must seem unsatisfactory to you, but even from what I can only outline, you can already tell that what I am characterizing as spiritual science is not a mere figment of the imagination. Of course, all this is something we're not used to. It is new to us. But once we have accomplished the metamorphosis of consciousness, what we constructively present to ourselves inwardly appears before our mind with as much inner clarity as any mathematical or geometrical fact we call to mind. And the latter are, after all, also constructed from within us. Now, when people tell me I should only claim what everyone can understand, I answer that I am indeed doing that. But the point is that those who want to understand something must first undergo everything that is necessary for such understanding. Just as people who want to solve a differential equation must first go through what will then enable them to solve the equation. And some people then object that mathematics and geometry only present the mind with what we then apply when we examine and analyze the reality of the outside world. Well, I always tell people who raise this objection that they are right, but that when we call something to mind constructively, we become convinced that it is something merely formal. Whereas when we have what I characterized in our consciousness, we know it is a reality. And to those who allege that this may all be just auto-suggestion, I say that everything which enables us to say that something is real in the first place is only a result of experience. Now, some people object that people could be mistaken or deceive themselves. For example, someone could have a vivid thought of the sour flavor of lemon juice, and if sensitive enough, the person might even have the sensation of tasting the sour lemon juice. Of course, I tell these people, too, that they are right, and this is indeed possible. But after all, in ordinary life, we can tell the difference between heat we merely think of and heat that actually affects us when we touch a hot iron, for example. Likewise, when we have attained seeing consciousness, we can tell the difference, thanks to our inner experiencing, between what is merely fantasy, merely suggestion, and what is reality. For all grasping of reality is essentially an inner experience. In all this, it is essential to follow things through to the end and not stop somewhere along the way. Those who stop where the actual path continues on may be the ones succumbing to suggestion. That is why I say it is indeed possible that people who are sensitive and who yield to auto-suggestion actually taste the flavor of lemonade when they merely are thinking of drinking lemonade. Nevertheless, their thirst will not be quenched by the lemonade they are merely thinking of. What matters is to move from the taste sensation to actually quenching the thirst. That is to follow the path consistently. Consistently following the path of experience means that one calls something a reality in the spiritual sense also entirely on the basis of experience. Calling something a sensory reality can basically not be the result of theorizing, but is always the result of experience. Ladies and gentlemen, I have now characterized the spiritual science we arrive at when we, as thoroughly modern scientific persons, go through what life today presents to us. Indeed, life has changed a lot in the past 30 to 50 years through major changes in technology. I remember the years when the first professorship for technology was established at the University of Vienna in the early 80s of the 19th century. Looking back over everything that has happened since then makes me realize how much we as modern human beings have changed as a result of all that has entered into our life in terms of knowledge, ethics, and above all our social organization. Now, it is especially those people who have honestly gone through all of this and do not reject the natural sciences out of prejudice, believing they cannot give us anything, but who instead take the position that the natural sciences have much to offer us, that is, people who put heart and soul into learning about the triumphs of the modern sciences, they are the ones who can realize that the spiritual element at the basis of the world must be comprehended in the way I have tried to describe for you today. Looking back at earlier times of humanity's development, we realize that in those earlier times of human history, people rarely spoke about the spirit. The way they spoke about spirit has traditionally been preserved in various religious confessions, and these confessions can no longer be reconciled with the findings of the ordinary natural sciences, at least if we don't want to keep a double entry ledger of our life. We just have to admit that those spiritual experiences arose from a very different state of consciousness back then. In fact, through what we have learned over the past 3 or 4 centuries, during which the methods of the natural sciences were developed, the condition of our soul that has developed as a result of the ways of thinking advanced by Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler, insofar as we have undergone in modern times everything that has extracted laws of technology from the laws of the natural sciences, through all of this, we have not only attained results and insights, but all of civilized humanity has also received a certain kind of education. The entire configuration of the human soul has become different, not because we have become more theoretical, but because we have become more conscious. As a necessity, we had to leave behind certain instinctual conditions of earlier ages. Looking back at what people in earlier ages felt as spirituality, spirituality that has been preserved in religious traditions, we see that the spirituality that existed back then was grasped through human instinct. That is, to comprehend that spirituality in those epochs, it was not necessary to raise human consciousness out of and beyond the methods of the natural sciences and the methods of the social experience of our modern times. Instead, in those earlier times, people talked of the spirit as something that the natural phenomena they perceived gave them. The spirit they talked of was given to them together with the natural phenomena in their perception. For example, how did the ancient Egyptians relate to the world? They looked up to the sky and traced the course of the stars, the constellations of the night sky. The ancient Egyptians saw in the starry sky not only what Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler later also saw. Rather, what the ancient Egyptians saw in the stars revealed to them at the same time something spiritual. Just as now when I move my arm, an activity in my soul underlies that movement. Likewise, people in that earlier epoch felt something spiritual underlying what was happening externally, and they felt it instinctively. Then our modern times arose, the epoch of the natural sciences. As I see it, we can now look back on a long period of time that actually did not end until about the middle of the 15th century. During this long period of human development, people could not do otherwise than see the sensory perceptions all around them as also spiritual at the same time. When we talk today about different aggregate states of matter, namely of solid, liquid, and gaseous states of matter, then we are clearly focused on the material. In contrast, ancient people saw what we call states of aggregation. They saw these also as elements that were, however, not merely material, but at the same time also something spiritual that revealed itself in these elements. For the ancients, the material world around them was the external, physical expression of the soul spiritual. Just as for us, the physical organism is the expression of the soul spiritual, except that for the ancients, all of this was instinctive. In the past 3 or 4 centuries, humanity had of necessity to leave this path behind and move on to something very different, which then came to lead civilization. That is, humanity moved on to what lifted the perception of nature out of mere observation, which is, after all, always connected with the instinctive, spiritual perception of nature, something that still reverberates in our term, in quotes, view. In other words, people began to move on from merely observing nature to what we can call grasping nature through experimenting. Since the time when Bacon and others were active, mere observation of nature has gradually been replaced with an understanding of nature that is based on experimentation. We carry out experiments in the laboratory and in our studies, and then extend these experiments into technical work. By generating the conditions of a natural event ourselves, we can control these conditions and better understand them. When carrying out an experiment, we have a different relationship to nature than when we merely observe it. In observing nature, we cannot know whether what we see represents some sort of totality, or whether we will have to go deeper, much deeper, than seemed initially called for. And this is true whether we grasp what we observe with our intellect or our imagination. In short, despite all our careful observation, what we observe in nature remains something unknown to us. But when we carry out an experiment, we ourselves create the conditions for it. Then we can monitor how one thing arises as a result of another, and what is still unknown at that point is really what is of the most interest for us. People who set up an experiment and then observe what there is to observe are actually looking at the result that follows from the controlled conditions they started with, That is, in experiments, everything becomes transparent to us in a way that is very different from when we observe events in nature. Thus, people have gradually become accustomed to see in controlled experiments the interpreter of nature. In a way, the laws of nature are observed where people themselves can monitor the conditions of these laws' disclosure. This experimental method, however, is still accompanied by a certain longing that in earlier times had thoroughly sustained knowledge. In those ancient times when technology and the natural sciences, as we know them, did not yet exist, what people then called science grew primarily out of the longing to know, to explore, to, quote, understand whatever binds the world's innermost core together, so, close quote, if I may put it that way. Now that the experimental method has taken hold, it is not only the longing to know that motivates us, but also the longing to recreate what nature has formed. Yes, the old yearning for knowledge still lives on. We recreate what we want to focus on in our experiments, so that through what we can control and manage in the experiment, we can unravel nature's mysteries. Therefore, it was in a sense only natural that in modern times technology grew out of this experimental method, and with this technology we have entered a new phase. Thus, to sum up, in the history of humanity there was first exploration and research based on a longing for knowledge, and then there followed the experimental method, in which, however, the longing of the ancient striving for knowledge unites with the reproduction of nature. We need only observe what actually happened to see that we moved on from what can be experienced with experiments to what then becomes of the natural laws discerned through experiments when they are applied in the technological forms that reach so deeply into human life, especially social life. And here we have to admit that there is yet a third element which transitions from what we still have in the reproduction of nature to what is now creatively active in the human being. Regarding what I want to say about that creative element, I believe I am not speaking here to insensitive souls when I describe this creative element to you as follows. People who undergo technical training with that characteristic style, that particular soul condition, will feel and experience themselves in that training differently than people who are undergoing, for example, theological training that replicates the most ancient methods of knowing and perceiving, or people who undergo training in the natural sciences that is already based on the experimental method. The latter, as part of the training in the natural sciences based on experiments, will apply mathematics, geometry, theoretical mechanics, forometry, and so on, to what they observe there. In a sense, they are recalculating nature. Of course, people approach the matter from a very different standpoint in their consciousness when they consider what is, in a sense, inwardly fully transparent, namely mathematics and geometry. And when they apply this not only to experiments, that is, in reproducing nature, but also to the completely free and creative work of designing machines. As you can imagine, to see what one has experienced as mathematics, as theoretical and mechanical chemistry, now flowing out into the design of a technological construct, is to experience the world quite differently from the way in which natural scientists or theorizing technicians experience it. What is that difference actually? You see, people often overlook an important consideration. For example, consider that in our ordinary trivial life, we call all sorts of things, in quotes, real, including those things that are not real in a higher sense. Thus we call a rose real, but is a rose real in a higher sense? When I have it here in my hands, plucked from the rose bush, it cannot go on living. The rose can only be formed as it is, as long as it grows on a branch of a rose bush, ultimately out of the root of the rose bush. As soon as I cut the rose off from the bush, all I have in my hands is actually a real abstraction, something that cannot persist as it now is. Of course, this is true of every natural object in a certain sense. I cannot understand any objects in nature, not even crystals, where this applies to the least extent, by simply looking at them. For, essentially, even crystals can no more persist solely out of themselves than roses can. That is, I have to admit that crystals are only possible in the totality of their environment, perhaps having grown as parts of a druce when mountains were forming. However, my position is completely different when I look at technical objects that I have made myself. My relationship to what I have made is different from the one I just described. We can sense this and even feel that it is something of dramatic significance in the experience of modern human beings as we look from the perspective of our technical training at what technology has become in modern life. A technical object that I have constructed based on mathematics and theoretical mechanics is something that is complete and self-contained. And as I live within what is essentially the circumference of all technological creations, I see there not only an image of the laws of nature, but actually something new, which has, in a sense, turned the laws of nature into technical objects. What I see is new, different from the laws underlying technical creations, different from what underlies inorganic nature. What is happening here is not just that the laws of inorganic nature are simply being applied to another sphere. The entire significance of the technical creation in its relation to the cosmos changes when I, as a freely and creatively active human being, transfer my usual experience of the shaping of physical or chemical experiments into a technical object. This means that modern humanity is succeeding in extracting its technology out of the totality of nature. And thus, in our modern times, we have had to learn to live with technology in such a way that our human consciousness has a very different relationship to technology than we have to what is created by nature. That is, we now, for the first time, face a world that is to a certain extent transparent for the soul. The world of the natural sciences is, in a sense, opaque for the soul. We cannot see through to the bottom of it. The world of technology, however, is like a transparent crystal, as understood by the soul, of course. In other words, with the emergence of modern technology, a new stage of spiritual development has arisen for humanity. Something new entered the history of humanity's development, and that is why even modern philosophers did not know what to make of the changes in modern consciousness that have come about as a result of the triumphs of technology. In particular, if you'll allow me to point this out, the purely philosophical, speculative way of thinking has had no clue what to make of the effects of technology that have taken hold of modern human consciousness. Indeed, today we are much more affected by what comes from the leading streams of human development than we think. The general consciousness we are familiar with today did not yet exist in the days before there was journalism, and when the only way people could cultivate any intellectual or spiritual exchange was to go to church on Sundays and hear the pastor speak from the pulpit. What we consider general education today flows through certain channels from the leading currents of the time into the vast masses without people even noticing. And that is essentially why what has emerged through the technical consciousness has shaped the ways of thinking of the broad masses in just a short period of time, and lives in the masses without them being aware of it. And so we can say that something entirely new has entered our world, and wherever consciousness has become one-sided, something that has fortunately not yet come to Europe, where consciousness has become totally one-sided and practically obsessed with what has been abstracted or extracted, there a strange philosophy has emerged, namely the so-called pragmatism of William James and others. They all say that truth, ideas that want to be only truth and nothing more, are in general something unreal. According to those philosophers, the only real truth is the one that can be implemented, that has practical application. Thus, according to pragmatism, as human beings we set ourselves certain goals, and we shape reality in accordance with those. And when we see that this or that is real, based on a law of nature, then we make an object corresponding to that. If we can manifest in machines, in mechanics, what we have conceived, then we take the application in life as proof that the conception is true. For pragmatism, there is no other proof than that of application in life. Thus, for pragmatist philosophers, only what we can implement in life is true. This so-called pragmatism, which rejects all inner logical pursuit of truth and actually accepts only verification of truth through what is happening in the outside world, figures today in the widest circles as American philosophy per se. And for several decades now, it has even taken hold of some people in Europe, even before the war. From this we see that philosophers who still want to think along the old lines cannot think of anything else to do with modern technology, the consciousness of modern technology, than to do away with the concept of truth as such. Having left behind the instinctive comprehension of nature and the reproduction of nature in experiments, they moved on to the free shaping of nature. They had no other option left than the free and creative shaping of the outer world. This amounts to a denial of the inner experience of truth, of the experience within one's soul of the spiritual that can permeate the human soul. Instead, only what can be implemented, realized in external utilitarian objects, is considered truth. In other words, the self-sustaining concept of truth in the human soul has actually been dismissed. Now, another development is also possible. A development is possible whereby we experience that in the actual substance of technical objects, something withdraws from the natural, in which there is now no longer anything we could surmise, but only what we can survey. For if we cannot grasp it, we also cannot shape it. By experiencing this, by fully letting the experience permeate us, a certain need will inevitably grow all the stronger within us. This new external world presents itself to us without any inner verification of ideas. That is, it presents itself to us without the inner experience of the ideas. That is why this new experience prepares us for the pure experiencing of spirituality, of what the human being, removed from all external observation, must experience inwardly, in the way I tried to sketch for you at the beginning of my talk today. And so I believe that we have advanced in human development to a view of reality where we can outwardly survey it and no longer see anything demonic or ghost-like accompanying our perceptions of the external world. That is, we have finally arrived at the point where we no longer interpret sensory perceptions of the outside world as essentially opaque, and therefore assume that there is something spiritual behind them. As a result, we must now seek the forces for the spirit within us by developing the soul ourselves. It has always seemed to me that a true and honest experience of the consciousness that comes to us from technology demands that we now experience within us what is spiritual. Otherwise, we stand to lose what is intimately tied up with our human nature. We must attain this inner experience of the spiritual in order to add to the one pole of transparent mechanics and transparent chemistry, the other pole, namely, what can be attained with spiritual perception, what can appear before the human spirit. It seems to me that in our time, it is necessary that the spiritual perception of anthroposophy reveals itself precisely because we have now reached a certain level of development in the history of humanity. And there is another thing we must add to this, ladies and gentlemen, namely that with the new technology, social changes have occurred too. I don't need to explain to you that particularly this modern technology has brought about modern industrialism as well as the modern proletariat, as we know these two developments today. But it seems to me that if we only want to take the standpoints of the older scientific method, the standpoint that is based on what follows from observation, then our thoughts will fall short. We won't get to the point of entirely comprehending what is revealing itself in our social life. To understand how human development shapes human social life, it is necessary to arrive at the truths that reveal themselves only through human nature itself. And that's why I believe that Marxism and all other quackery like that, about which people today are in such an uproar, can be overcome only when we find special methods that can be used as the necessary antithesis to technology, and that are then applied to human social life. More than that, we must in this way carry spirituality into the masses, because we ourselves have found this spirituality through our inner experiences. Therefore, it is not by accident that the same soil out of which anthroposophically oriented spiritual science grew, though I really had not sought it, also gave rise to what I presented in my book titled Towards Social Renewal. In that book, I simply tried to draw the necessary conclusions from what the knowledge of spiritual science can contribute to our social world. And what I presented in that book came to me of its own accord. Without spiritual science, I don't believe that methods can be found which grasp how we relate to each other as individuals in our social world. And I believe that because we have not yet reached the point of really knowing our social world and therefore cannot master it, people have fallen first into chaos the very moment they were faced with the necessity of reconstruction after the terrible catastrophe of the war. It is necessary that we accomplish what must be done by proceeding on the basis of spiritual laws, not on the basis of any law that is mistakenly thought to be grounded in natural law. That is the mistake Marxism and other similar radical variants of the social sciences fall prey to. Ladies and gentlemen, I value being allowed to explain here before you something that is for me basically very personal. Speaking to you like this, I feel myself in this moment transported back to an earlier time, to the 90s of the 19th century, when we were all living in Central Europe, in a time we felt was a time of advancement, or a boom. And now we, that is, those who are like me and that they have grown old, we have reached a point in time when the hopes and anticipation of a new beginning of those days now stand before our mind's eye as a tragic appearance. Looking back upon what then seemed to be an unstoppable ascent, we realize that we are now looking at something that reveals itself for many people as something which in many respects was an error. By speaking to you, I am speaking to students who are in a different position. Many of you are probably the same age I was when I experienced those hopes of a new beginning. And now you are experiencing something that is very different from the fantasies that arose for the human soul back then on the heels of those hopes and aspirations. But no one who is as firmly convinced of the possibility and necessity of spiritual knowledge as the one who is now speaking to you can ever be pessimistic about the strength of human nature, but only optimistic. And that is why it does not seem to me that I am contemplating an impossibility in my soul, when I envision that, when you have reached the age at which I am speaking to you now, you will have traveled along the opposite path, namely the path that, thanks to the strength of the human soul, particularly its spiritual strength, now leads upward again. And because, based on spiritual knowledge, I believe in the human being, I believe that we cannot speak, as Spengler does, of a decline or end of Western civilization. Rather, just as I believe in the strength of the soul that lives in you, I also believe that we must again begin to move upward. And that ascent will not come through a hollow phantom, but through the human will. My faith in the truth of the spiritual science I told you about is so strong that I am convinced that this human will can be sustained, can effect a new upward movement, a new dawn. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I would like to conclude with the words that reverberated in my mind when I was a young student and heard the inaugural address of the new rector of the Department of Mechanics and Mechanical Engineering in Vienna. Back then he was speaking to people who also believed in a new ascent and advance, and they were right in believing that, even though what followed was only one-sided technical progress, not a social or political one. Now, however, we are living in a time in which we can only think of upward movement. Indeed, we must think only of ascent if we are not to despair. For that reason, I want to say to you what that man said to us, young people, back then, quote, "Dear students, I conclude by saying that those who are sincere in their feelings for the development of humanity, in regard to what is to come out of the sciences and technology, can only say, onward and upward." Close quote. The end of Lecture 1.